Cities can be many amazing things. Engines of growth and prosperity, job creators, innovation hubs, fun and fulfilling places to live and learn. No country got rich, ever, without urbanizing. But urbanizing alone is no guarantee of development. Why is that? And what can we do about it in the world's fastest urbanizing regions, notably Africa, where by 2050, it's expected 900 million people, yep, 900 million, will be added to their cities. Welcome back to Ideas in Development. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and this is the first episode of our new series on cities, for which I'm super excited to be joined by Curtis Lockhart to talk all things cities with a stellar lineup of practitioners and researchers. Curtis, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Yeah, thanks, Oliver. Really excited to co-host this cities series with you.
So, Curtis, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about yourself and how you wound up focusing your work on cities.
Yeah, so, just first off, I'm set the basics. I'm Curtis Lockhart, as said. I'm founder and executive director of the Africa Urban Lab, or AUL, which is a research center and policy lab housed at the African School of Economics, Zanzibar. The AUL, right, as the name suggests, we're really focused on the massive challenges, but also the massive opportunities of hugely rapid urbanization as it's unfolding across Africa this century. And to answer your question, Oliver, I got interested in cities really because I got interested in the question of economic growth, right, in the wealth and poverty of nations and in how humans could effectively change that through policy. You probably know, like Lucas wrote in this 1988 paper, basically, once you start thinking about growth, it's hard to think about anything else because it does have such huge, massive, cumulative consequences over the long run. But as I read, I came to see cities as the key driver, at least a major primary driver of growth. Everything, you know, everything that economists care about for growth is massively concentrated in the world's cities. Studies show that cities significantly boost productivity, both at the individual and the firm level. They make us smarter through boosting human capital. People in cities are healthier and live longer today. That was not always the case, especially in the 19th century. And as a result, like more skilled and smart people interacting in cities results in much higher levels of innovation and much higher wages, right? And when it comes to jobs, creating formal jobs being one of the best things you can do for development, a full 80% of private sector jobs created between 2010 and 2020, they were generated in big cities, right? 80%. This is one of the key reasons I focus on cities. Also just the general kind of rule of thumb that for every 10% increase in the share of a country's urban population, its output per capita usually increases by about 30% or so. And so that creates over time these huge differences between urban and non-urban areas. And then I guess what's more, there's, to your point, you said it in your intro, there's not really a single exception to this general rule that no country has ever gotten rich without urbanizing, right? Without going through urban transition. So, you know, that's my rational brain-led answer. The heart-led answer is that I just love cities. I love spending time in cities. I love spending whole days walking through cities. I love the energy and bustle of city streets. And I love the serendipity that just seems to magically happen more in cities. I love cities. And honestly, the heart-led answer it probably is the more honest answer that preceded the brain-led answer. I just found a way to rationalize focusing my life on something I'd already, you know, fallen madly in love with. So,
and why African cities in particular?
Okay, so three main reasons. So first, poverty. I care about reducing poverty at scale through sustained economic growth. And if you look at the numbers today, Africa is home to about 16% of the world's population, but hosts about 67% of the world's extreme poverty. So like two-thirds of the world's poor are concentrated in the African continent. This wasn't always the case, right? Even as recent as 2000, Asia was home to most of the world's extreme poor, but Asia basically was able to nearly wipe out extreme poverty through rapid economic growth over the last quarter century. And then if we zoom forward over the course of the 21st century, poverty will increasingly become an African problem. And so that's number one. Number two is demographics. This is kind of a related but a distinct point to the first point. But by the end of this century, so in 2100, which is less than 75 years away, that's not a long time, folks, Africa will be home to 4 out of every 5 human beings on the planet, right? And post 2050 or so, so just 25 years away, Africa will be like the only region on the planet driving human population growth. And just so if we're thinking about the scale of a problem and the impact that you can have, Africa's humanity's demographic future and a larger and larger slice of the human family will be concentrated on the continent, as well as a larger and larger slice of humanity's worst off. And so I answered, I guess, why Africa, which brings me maybe to third, why African cities. So in my first answer, I already explained the magic of cities, right? Cities make us smarter, more productive. They boost our incomes. They create jobs. They scale firms. They make our lives basically better on almost every conceivable metric that we care about. But this link between urbanization and prosperity is breaking down across fast-growing African cities today, right? There's a bunch of great studies that attest to this, but to me, the best single one is Doug Golan, Remy Jedweb, and Walrath literally wrote a paper called Urbanization With and Without Industrialization. And there's this like terrifying graph in that paper that like haunts my worst nightmares and should affect the sleep of many, many more people, where the relationship between urbanization and the share of the economy made up by manufacturing and services, so structural transformation, right? It's very positively correlated in every single region except Africa. I think they include parts of the Middle East with the graph with Africa, but for Africa, right, there is no relationship between urbanization and structural transformation. It's a flat line, and that should keep us up at night. Because if this link is not restored, it effectively means that the nearly 1 billion people, you said 900 million people, being added to these cities between now and mid-century, they lead worse lives. They're just significantly worse off, poorer, less employed, less upwardly mobile, less skilled, less productive. It would be a tragic, tragic missed opportunity if this rapid urban transition was not taken full advantage of. So to me, this is one of the biggest policy imperatives of the 21st century is getting African urbanization right.
And I mentioned this kind of crazy 900 million number in the intro, which I came across in your asterisk essay from, I believe it was last year, called Yes in My Bamako Yard. Can you help us get our heads around what that actually means in practical terms? What does that look like on the ground in the African cities you work in?
So yeah, that 900 million number should make people open their eyes a bit, I think. So basically this is over a doubling in Africa's current urban population, but not quite a tripling by 2050. So that's an average urban growth rate of roughly 3.5 to 4% per year. So that's cities doubling in size about every 18 to 20 years or so. And just to make this concrete, Oliver, right, you're in London. Imagine London doubling in 18 to 20 years, right? Now, like some faster growing African cities, they'll triple or they'll quadruple or more in that time period. So imagine London tripling or quadrupling in less than 2 decades. It is kind of hard to fathom today for Westerners in Western cities. I guess another way to make this concrete, the current combined total population of the United States and Europe, it's roughly around 800 million people or so. So we're talking about building in 25 years the equivalent of the entire American and European city systems today from scratch. You know, other stats in Africa, about 1/2 to 2/3 of the physical urban space, the built environment that Africa will need by 2050, does not exist today. it all needs to be built between now and mid-century. Just in terms of the context, we're building that city system at a much lower income level than was historically the case in other regions during their periods of urban transition. So just by way of example, if you look back in history, the U.S. hit 50% urbanized around 1920, and they at that time had per capita incomes of around $7,500 per person. Fast forward to the late 1970s, South Korea and much of East Asia hits around 50% urbanized at around $4,500 per person. Fast forward to today, and much of Africa is careening rapidly towards 50% urbanized, by most estimates, it's at 44 or 45%, at per capita incomes of around $2,000 or $2,500 per person. So just significantly less income, which means there's just a much lower tax base to finance the building needed. You need lots of urban infrastructure to make these cities function effectively at that size. Water, sanitation, roads, power, housing. And it all costs money. Money that many African cities are going to be behind their historical peers in being able to raise. And, you know, not to mention that building upwards, right, building densely is much more costly as well. So we're likely to see less of that, at least at the beginning. So just to answer your question of, you know, what the status quo trend looks like on the ground, adding almost a billion people in a quarter century, without any changes, it'll likely look like, one, a lot of informality, basically slums, and two, a lot of disconnected urban sprawl because density is expensive. And both of these things are just really bad for urban productivity. So we want to do whatever we can to try and change those status quo trends and do so as quickly as possible, because city form and urban infrastructure, they have this lock-in effect, right? There's a path dependence. So once streets and housing and other bulky infrastructure is built, it's sticky. It's hard and expensive to completely redesign. And so smart urban policy choices, you know, they got to be made today and they got to be made quickly.
And this is exactly the problem that you founded the Africa Urban Lab to work on. Could you tell us a bit about the lab itself? I guess how you came to set it up and what exactly you're working on day to day?
Yeah, so maybe just a little background first in terms of setup. Before the Africa Urban Lab, I was first head of research and then executive director of the Charter Cities Institute, or CCI, which is a think tank based out of Washington, D.C., that's also focused on harnessing rapid urbanization across the developing world to boost growth. And so the Africa Urban Lab was really incubated out of CCI and lived there as a sort of special project during our initial stages. So we came into being through the support and incubation of CCI, and we couldn't have had a more supportive co-founding institution. So that's our origin story. Now, in terms of the second part of your question, what the Africa Urban Lab actually does. So as mentioned at the beginning, right, we're a research center and a policy lab. We're housed at ASC Zanzibar, which is the newest campus, the newest kind of addition to Leonard Wanchukwu's Pan-African ASE university system, which I know we'll chat about in one of the episodes with Leonard later on in the series. And we're focused on three key activities. So one is education and training. So we train up the city leaders, the urban planners, the city builders across the continent. We do this mainly through a professional diploma in urban development. So we've had mayors take our program. We've had deputy mayors. We've had senior directors of central ministries in charge of planning and urban development. And we've had mostly a bunch of senior urban planners from across cities across the continent. Our current diploma cohort has about 50 students and they're professionals, 50 students from 15 countries across every region of the continent. And, you know, one of the big things among many others that the diploma strives to do is that it wants to much more tightly integrate urban planning teaching with urban economics, right? The regulatory decisions made by urban planners, oftentimes they have these huge, massive consequences for economic fates of cities. And most urban planners are not taught how to adequately think about those economic consequences and trade-offs. And so we want to put this front and center in the curriculum. So that's number one. The second thing we do is research, right? We are, after all, housed at a university, so we do conduct rigorous academic research across four different research themes that I do not have to go into now. I'll just refer interested researchers to the framing papers on our website. I should also note, just flagging for those interested researchers, the AUL is going to launch a network of fellows this month in April. And so if you're a scholar doing great work on African cities, I just may like subscribe to our newsletter to keep informed about these upcoming fellowship opportunities. And then thirdly, and I think really importantly, the third key activity we do is policy implementation. We realize that we can write, you know, these amazing research papers and these amazing policy recommendations, but nobody reads them, right? Maybe with the obvious big exception of huge swaths of Vox Dev's listeners, but very few African policymakers are reading research. So we realized that if we're going to succeed in translating any of the most cost-effective urban policies pinpointed by the research into actual policy action in the real world, we've got to devote a lot of time, resources, effort, energy into actively working with city governments on policy implementation. And so right now we've got two policy implementation work streams. One is called Urban Expansion in the Periphery. That's a standalone program led by Dr. Patrick Lempson Hall, who's working with around 30 fast-growing cities, mostly across East Africa, on this proactive bare bones urban expansion planning framework. And then the second is an urban finance program. And this program I'm still actively fundraising for, but it's focused on how we can help African cities more effectively raise revenue, improve spending and budget execution, and become creditworthy and potentially tap, ideally, domestic capital markets. So apologies for that very long rant, but that's what the Africa Urban Lab is up to. And I should say, we are also going to launch a podcast. In fact, should be out by the time this episode airs. So if your listeners are interested in cities, AUL podcast, check it out.
Yeah, and one thing you mentioned at the start of your answer there, which I wanted to get into a bit more, was the intellectual landscape when it comes to cities. You kind of mentioned that there's kind of this almost divide between the urban planners and the urban economists, and cities sit at this intersection of a bunch of different disciplines, right? There's economics, urban planning, geography, political science. How do you think about the different disciplines that study cities? Could you maybe take us through how their approaches may differ?
Yeah, and I'm going to focus on the urban planners and the urban economists, just because, you know, as mentioned and alluded to in your question, and I talked about it before, a big raison d'etre for the lab is to more tightly integrate recent insights from really rigorous urban economics into planning curriculum across the continent. And so I'd say, like, the main difference to me between planners and economists is that I think planners tend to have a lot more faith, I think, in top-down rules, just like working. And I think sometimes that they can lack a lot of the mental models, tools that could better anticipate the second or the third order consequences of those planning decisions on, you know, the people in their city, the firms in their city, the urban form over time, and the growth of their cities. You know, basically, I think a big problem with a lot of urban planners and planning curriculum is that they haven't read Alain Berteau. So, like, if you're a planner and you want to better understand the economic consequences of your planning decisions, Alain Berteau's book, Order Without Design, is probably the single best source that you can go to. So pro tip. And then I guess on the flip side, so some economists, probably less so urban economists, but some economists can perhaps get a little too cozy with laissez-faire in cities. I think Ed Glaser or somebody commonly quips that just as there are no atheists in the foxhole, there are no libertarians in the city. I think especially for big cities, there can be such huge positive and negative externalities that arise with density that there's just really no substitute for an effective urban government to help manage these massive externalities. So yeah, I mean, just focusing on the difference between urban planners and urban economists, I'd say to me, those are the two big ones that stick out.
In terms of giving the listeners a taste of what's to come in this series across the various conversations that we've got lined up, we're going to be talking to a range of leading academics and practitioners about some of the big themes that you've raised in this episode. Let me run through them and maybe you can say a word about what listeners can expect to learn or listen to in each. So first up, we have an episode on how cities can pay for stuff.
Yeah. So on this one, we have Astrid Haas joining us, who she used to lead the International Growth Center Cities That Work initiative. Now she's, among many other things, a lecturer at the Africa Urban Lab. Basically, African cities are really, 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 really under-resourced for the scale and scope of the urbanization challenge that they have to face over the next several decades. So Astrid goes over some promising models and examples from some African cities and then cities abroad that have dealt relatively well with urban finance, with paying for this stuff. Whether it's improved property or land taxation, whether it's improved intergovernmental transfers, or whether it's improved sort of creditworthiness and borrowing.
And then we have an episode on building houses in Africa and what it would take to make the Yimby movement truly go global.
Yeah, so on housing, we have Kessia Rust joining us. So she's executive director of CAF. For those who don't know CAF, it's the Center for Affordable Housing Finance, based out of South Africa. They do great work. We talk a lot about a lot of interesting bottlenecks and financial constraints around getting the required level of housing built on the continent. And I really loved the discussion we had with Kessia on nascent mortgage markets across the continent, because this is a topic I think is really understudied. You know, how did the very early nascent mortgage markets emerge in Europe and North America in the 19th and early 20th centuries? And, you know, what are some lessons emerging African markets can learn from these earlier experiences? So that was a fascinating conversation around housing with Kessia to look forward to.
And then we're going to be going to Rwanda to talk all about their experience with their super impressive land reform journey.
On land reform, just for listeners, like dysfunctional land markets, especially urban land markets, are probably, I would wager, the biggest single bottleneck to improved urban growth, to improved urban expansion across at least African cities, which I know best. So we definitely wanted to speak with somebody on these issues of land and especially urban land. So we spoke with Thierry Hosa Ngoga on this, and, you know, lots of conversations about land reform, they often are from researchers or they're from authors like Hernando de Soto is a common guy who's been on the land reform train since the 90s, and it can feel a bit abstracted. So Thierry actually led the thing. He led the implementation of, I think, by far the most successful land regularization drive in African history in Rwanda. Basically in 5 years, I think it was between 2007 and 2012, he and his team registered 11 million parcels of land across the country. They issued 7 million title deeds, and they did this all for the crazily low cost-effective price of $7 per parcel. And so, you know, we dive into this in the urban land episode with Tyria, and it's super, super important.
Yeah, and then after that, we're moving on to talk about crime in cities and thinking about how in various cities around the world over history, crime has taken over urban settings.
Yeah, and on urban crime, we speak with Professor Chris Blattman. So he's probably like the single global expert, at least the single economic expert that I know of who knows most about how urban gangs and organized crime in cities function. And knows kind of cost-effective tools to try and curb gangs and organized crime from cropping up. And so this episode, really, it arose because I wrote that essay in Asterisk last summer that you alluded to, Oliver, and Chris responded with a characteristically very smart thread, basically saying like, I don't know, Curtis, a lot of these African cities have a non-negligible chance at getting overrun by gangs. And if they don't do something now to stop that, you know, all bets are off. And so I loved this conversation with Chris mainly because urban crime isn't an area I've dived deeply into yet. And as Chris points out, in fact, very, very, very few researchers focus rigorously on urban gangs and organized crime at all, considering how important this issue is. So this one was great. And I think there are a lot of things that African cities, and in particular African mayors, can think about when it comes to improving police forces and police management to help mitigate these issues.
And then we move on to how cities can become a hub of youth opportunity. Africa has the youngest population of any continent, and you mentioned how demographics was one of the reasons why Africa Urban Lab exists, and you do the work you do. And we're going to be talking about how youth and young people interact with the urbanization story on the continent.
Yeah, as I said, post 2050, Africa is the only region on the planet driving human population growth. The median age in Africa right now is 19 years old. By comparison, I think the median age of Europe is like 43 or something, 42. So it's just a very, very young continent. The continent's cities, therefore, will be won or lost by its youth, right? And so on youth, we speak with Professor Leonard Wanchukwun. Listeners, they'll learn about, you know, among other things, Leonard's efforts founding and growing the African School of Economics to expand opportunity for the continent's youth. They'll learn how cities and urbanization, in addition to all their other benefits, can hugely raise the aspirations of youth. Something that I know Leonard cares a lot about, and he's actually done a lot of research on raising aspirations. But Leonard also covers like the downside when these raised aspirations are not met by city governments, and when they go unanswered, there's a big potential for disruption and a big potential for urban protest and youth-led protest, which we also get into with Leonard, and he's also done rigorous research on.
And finally, we have an episode that we're calling The Perfect City, with the caveat that pretty soon into our conversation, we realized that that probably doesn't exist.
Yeah. And so on this one, I liked this episode. It was like, I was more kind of navel gazing and kind of stroking our chins of what a city could be. We speak with Ed Glaser on quote unquote, The Perfect City. You know, I don't think Ed needs any introduction. He's done like dozens of Vox Dev videos. It's Ed Glaser in cities. People should just listen to it.
Yeah, he has like a crazy ability to make these throwaway comments that you think about, and then you're like, oh, I could read like a whole 2,000 word article just on that comment. So yeah, lots of interesting episodes coming up with a range of super interesting and thoughtful people. So we hope you find them useful and insightful, and it would really help us if you share this series with your colleagues, with your friends, anyone who might be interested. And also wherever you're listening, make sure to give us a 5-star rating and a like. And you can always comment if you have a further question, and we'll always try and get around to those. Curtis, do you have anything to add?
No, excited for the series.
This has been Ideas in Development, a Vox Dev podcast. As ever, you can find all past episodes of Ideas in Development on voxdev.org. We've also set up a Substack, so you can subscribe to the Substack to get an email whenever our latest episode has been released.